When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, this is The Rock Podcast, and I'm Denny Somach. I'm a rock historian, producer, and best-selling author. I bring you new conversations with some of rock's biggest personalities, as well as classic material from my archives. On this episode, my guest is Jerry Beckley of the band America, which was comprised of Jerry Beckley, Dewey Bunnell, and Dan Peek. Their debut album was released in late December 1971, It included the number one record, A Horse with No Name. Stay tuned, because you're going to get the story just like I got it, straight from the horse's mouth, or at least straight from Jerry. America had numerous hits, including Ventura Highway, I Need You, Tin Man, Sister Golden Hair, You Can Do Magic, The Sandman, and more. And they received a Grammy Award for Best New Artist in 1972. After they released their third album, Hat Trick, which was not as successful as their previous albums, they got a new producer, a guy named George Martin. The new album was Holiday. Beckley began releasing solo albums, starting with Van Gogan in 1975, and his most recent was titled Aurora. So I hope you enjoy the conversation with Jerry and what happened to the horse. It's a great story.
So let me ask you a question, because I did, of course, obviously I'm going to want to ask you about George Martin, but you grew up in England. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, you didn't you didn't see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, did you?
I did.
You did.
When now, I was trying to kind of simplify it, but both Dewey and I grew up in England, but only because our dads were in the Air Force and right. We were stationed there off and on.
Okay.
But we didn't just live in England for our. I was actually in the States. In 62, 63 for the Beach Boys and the Beatles right. And Ed Sullivan and same with Dewey. And it was a life-changing moment for all of us preteens and stuff. It redefined what we wanted to do. And it's no way to overstate what an impact that had.
So did you ever think that someday you'd be working with George Martin? And how did that come about?
At that time, I don't think we even really registered who George Martin. I don't think we knew quite the ins and outs of producer, you know, all the different other terms. But I'm sure his name was probably included on the sleeves. We didn't. Although I have to say that once I became deeply involved, and I was playing in bands since I was 10 or so, mm-hmm. surf bands and cover mm-hmm. bands. I was, as most were, deep readers of liner notes and studying right. of all the making. Of the records. So Dewey and I would sit there for hours with headphones and listen to Bridge Over Troubled Water and,
right.
and Pepper and Revolver and Pet Sounds and all of these wonderful pieces of work. So yeah, by that point we were familiar. So when George Martin's name intersected with ours in our career, he was by no means a secret. We knew all about him and did the world.
So how were you able to get him? Was it somebody at Warner Brothers or?
No, the simple answer is we called him up and asked him.
Really?
We had done the first three albums ourselves.
Right.
We co-produced the first one, did the second and third. Second was very successful with Ventura
right.
Highway. And
right.
we knew what we were doing and know how to do the record. But after the third one, which had become a bit of a chore, we thought of all the things that we're juggling, you know, having to tour every year, have to write the material, record the material. The production element was a crucial piece of the puzzle, but that we were probably going to have to farm it out. To somebody mm-hmm. that we trusted. And at the top of the list was George. And we had a list, short list of right. people we would interview. And he said yes. So we started at the top and we had a meeting with him in LA. He was in LA for the Academy Awards. He was nominated with Paul for Live and Let Die.
Right.
I think the song was up for Song of the thing, and maybe his score was nominated. I'm not sure. But mm-hmm. We had a meeting and I'd love to work. We were not an unknown.
Right.
Element. We'd had the number right. one record, multi-platinum album. It was a good fit. We were a singer-songwriter band. Right. And he had been not experiment, but doing very carefully chosen projects beyond the Beatles, once the Beatles had come to a halt in 69. So he had been doing other stuff. It wasn't like, oh, God, I wonder if he's going to be willing to dust off the old faders and get it back.
But he was very selective. He did Sea Train. He did American Flyer. Yeah. He didn't just do, I mean, people offering him, he really had to be into it.
Yeah, he did a lovely Jeff Beck album. I'm sorry. He did a Jeff Beck album.
Right.
Fantastic, Blow by Blow.
Yeah.
He did a Jimmy Webb album. We were all dear friends and fans of Jimmy. So, yes, he picked some good stuff, and we're honored to be in that. What we did bring to him was hits for the first time in quite a few years.
Right.
But all of those projects, it had his name on it. I guarantee it was a wonderful record. I mean, he just didn't do bad work. But they weren't always obviously charts. And so with the Holiday album, which was our fourth, but the first that he did, we went right back up the charts. Tin Man, Lonely People. We had back-to-back top 10 records.
Right.
The next one, the Heart album included Sister Golden Hair, which was a number one record. So he was back in a big way. We were
right.
It was good for all of us.
Yeah. So did he, ask him, tell me stories? I mean, what was going on? Give us the inside fly on the wall. I'm a Beatle fan too. By the way, if you give me some of your, I have a new Beatles book out, which I'll send you a copy of if you want. Mickey Dolenz wrote the foreword.
Okay.
It's comments from all these different people, from Jimmy Page to Carl Perkins.
I'd love to read it.
Okay.
Fly on the wall. Yeah. I always like to remind, because a George Martin name comes up, but you don't have to be that big of a Beatle fan to realize the importance of Jeff Emmerich, who was the engineer. And Jeff was in the, too. We had George and Jeff.
Jeff,
we got to know. I used to go have tea. Jeff had a little home in Laurel Canyon, and on his mantelpiece were three Grammys for Best Engineered Album. And they were Abbey Road, Sgt. Pepper, Abbey Road, and Band on the Run. So nice. He had some incredible stories too. But no, we didn't really waste time at all. These sessions were pretty focused. They were kind of 10 to 6 every day. What I would call civilized hours. There was no more until in the morning.
Right.
And it wasn't off limit. There was never a case of, and if I would say to Jeff, Jeff, now, how about that Lady Madonna piano sound? How'd you do that? And he certainly knew. He didn't want to like to dwell on it, but he'd tell me, oh, it was a lot of compression.
Right.
So, he would just kind of give you the short version, but he through that, he knew what you were asking, what you're after. So yes, to answer your question, in limited doses, we were exposed to a lot of lovely little stories.
Okay. And what studio did you use when you were working with him?
Well, we used Air Studios. George.
Yeah, that's his. Yeah.
All of those years, 7 albums we did with George, we worked a lot of places, but we never worked in Abbey Road. George was done with Abbey Road and his EMI deal was over. And he had built the first of a few Air Studios London. The first one was in New Oxford Circus.
Right.
And a lovely facility on the floor of an office building and stuff. That's where we went and did the first one. The second one, he came to the States. We did it up in the record plant. We recorded all over.
Right.
One at Caribou Ranch on the island of Kauai. We did some mixing at Montserrat when that was built.
Right.
The island in the Caribbean. But never at Abbey Road. So the irony is, once we stopped working with George, we then did some recording with Russ Ballard, who wrote and produced You Can Do Magic for us. And we went and did that in Abbey Road. So we ended up there anyway, but just years later.
Yeah. So you have, in addition to working with America, you put out a few solo albums. What do you have a best of out right now? A compilation or something?
I do. I have something. It's a summation, I'm calling it.
Good name.
It's a double album, 20 tracks. The label that I've been with for the last few solo albums, a little boutique label called Blue Alon, have been very supportive. And I've really enjoyed working with them. And Kirk Pasek, who's the head of the label, came to me and said, would I entertain? They had the rights to the last two, but there were 5 others. And I said, would I entertain doing a compilation? And I'd love to. So yes, called Keeping the Light On, the best of Jerry Beckley, and very proud of it. It's really something. The solo stuff was always kind of done, not as an afterthought. I focused just as much on it, but had to fit in the America stuff. But it has, over decades, built into quite a collection of tunes.
Yeah. All right. Let's just cover a couple of songs, because you've you know, some of the songs that you've written, Sister Golden Hair, something you want to say about that?
It was on a second of seven that we did with George. It gets a little confusing. It's our fifth record. The album's called Hearts. It was the opening single, a number one record for us. The first number one we'd had since Horse With No Name, that's never a bad thing. It was an exciting time for a previous album. It had a lot of hits and we were in a sense back, you know, 70s. The song itself, I like to give a nod to George Harrison. That combo of an acoustic 12 string with the slide guitar intro is very much kind of My Sweet Lord, you know. It's been a great addition to the show. From that point on, it was, you know, right up there in our playlist. And so we've ended the shows for decades now with the combo of Sister and Horse, which is not a bad way to wrap up an evening.
Right. Now, you also had a number one song with I Need You. What's the story behind that?
Yeah. I Need You was on our very first album. It was one of the first songs I wrote. I wrote it when I was 16. There was some talk of it being a single. And at the time we thought, no, maybe let's see if we've got anything else. The label said, can you go back in the studio after we just put out the album? And we recorded four more things, of which Horse was one of them. They picked that as the single. That's history. Everybody knows that. That was a number one record around the world. But we now needed a follow-up. So I Need You became the follow-up to Horse. Right. It is our most covered song. It was recorded at that time by all the great singers, the Johnny Mathises and Andy Williams and all those people. They had a thing in play where every year their album would be kind of Johnny Mathis sings Bridge Over Troubled Water and ten other great songs.
Yeah.
Whatever the songs that were familiar. And so I picked up some lovely covers. But one thing I do like to mention in that song was in 71, one of the first great artists we met was Harry Nilsson. And Harry had just had a number one with the Badfinger tune, Without You. And it was a lovely record. And when we met him, one of the first things he said to me was, are you going to release I Need You as a single? At the time, we said, no, the single is this Horse song we've got. And he said, because I'd like to cut that as the follow-up to Without You. Oh, my God, that would be so fantastic. And at the time, he was being produced by Richard Perry. And we then chose it as a single, and he had to shelve that idea. And I always thought, how great.
Did he ever cut it, not release it? He did cut it, not release it?
Later in 77, he did a series of albums back-to-back for RCA in the later 70s that didn't really have hits on it, but he did cut I Need You. So there is a lovely Harry.
Wow, that's great. Okay.
Oh, I've got another. Yeah. You're a Beatle guy.
Yeah. Please, give me your Beatle stories.
When we signed with Warners in 71, one of the pivotal characters in that office was Derek Taylor.
Right.
Who his official title was head of special projects, which basically meant Derek could do anything he wanted. Just nice to have him on the team. So that's it was through Derek that I met Harry. We met Harry. But one of the other guys that I right away met, I was going to the office and a group of people kind of rushing out, and Derek kind of sweeps me up and says, come on, get in the car. We're going to lunch. Get in the car. And he says, Jerry, this is George Harrison. George, this is Jerry of the group America. Met George Harrison. And in that lunch, I said to him, I have to tell you, I have a song called Need You on our first album. I used your title. And he looked at me and he says, that's okay, Jerry. I got it from someone else. So he was very sweet right from the start. I know you could have put that in your book. Right from the start.
I'll be in my next book. Absolutely.
So anyway, I'm always flattered and honored to have known George. He was a wonderful guy.
Did you ever meet John or Paul?
I met Paul a couple of times through Brian Wilson. I'm very close with all of the Beach Boys and the Wilson family.
Right.
And there was a birthday party for Brian that was actually quite documented and filmed for Saturday Night Live. And this is in the late 70s. And Paul was there. And I hung with him a little bit. Didn't know Paul or don't know Paul that well. Met Ringo quite a few times with Harry. Ringo and Harry were at the hip for many years.
Yeah, right.
And although it's legend, all of the times that Harry was with John, none of them included coming up to my... Harry used to come up to my house every other day, and I'd spend a lot of time with Harry, a lot of nights, but not during the last weekend. So no, I didn't share any. I think Dewey did. In fact, Dewey has a lovely story. Went to the record plant one day just to hang out. The plant was not only a great facility, but just a cool place, safe place to go. And when he went in, the receptionist said, oh, they're all back in Studio C. he didn't know who they were singing, but so, okay, I'll go back to see. And when he went in, it was Harry and John working on the podcast.
Wow. So, okay. You want to tell me something about Daisy Jane?
Daisy Jane was written at, I had a lovely little cottage in Sussex in the south of England for most of all the 70s and 80s, part of the 90s. I had a little upright piano and I did do some writing when I was there, but it was basically a place to decompress. That one of the interesting things about Daisy Jane is I'd never been to Memphis when I wrote it, and I'd never to this day knew anybody named Daisy Jane. But I always mentioned that we were big Nick Drake fans, and
really?
Nick Drake had a lovely track called Hazy Jane on, I'm not sure if it's on Brighter Later.
Five Leaves Left.
But a lovely song. And I think I was using Hazy Jane and combining it with Daisy Chain, you know, something. But that's where it came from. Wow. I'll tell you something about that Nick Drake album. I was commenting, I was doing a public radio thing in L.A., and people thought, oh, Five Leaves Left, it's some reference to, you know, the end of autumn, you know, we're going into the winter months, something. But the truth is, Five Leaves Left was a little notice at the near the end of a pack of rolling papers. If you were either rolled your own or were a pothead, you'd get this little warning when you got down to the papers. It said Five Leaves Left. And that's where the title came from.
That's great. I didn't know that. Oh, boy. Okay, so... let's see here. I wanted to ask you also, did you ever, I know you didn't record there, but did you ever get to Abbey Road to see it?
Yeah, I said we did with Russ Ballard when we did.
Oh, right. That's right. Okay.
We went back to Abbey Road and we have been there a couple times since.
Right.
Lovely, fantastic facility, historic, you know, as you well know, if you're in St. George and Jeff.
I've been there a few times. Yeah. All right. Now I'm going to ask you something that might be weird. But I know this was a long time ago. I don't even know if people still mention it to you or not, but I was a 19-year-old disc jockey when your first album came out. And I was one of those people who played it and said, oh my God, it's Neil Young in disguise. What? You got a lot of that back then, didn't you? On the horse with no name.
Yeah, sure.
What was your, you got to have
not
some.
Not only that, but there's a great story where Neil's dad contacted him and said, yeah, I heard your new song, that horse song. So Neil's dad thought it was horse. And so if you read his book, Shaky, I think he mentions it in there that, you know, he had to tell his dad, no, that's not me, Dad. You know, obviously we and Dewey in particular, very influenced by Neil. I will always claim, you know, After the Gold Rush, one of my favorite albums of all time, just a masterpiece.
Right.
Can't say enough about it. But again, in just this weird thing of timing, our bass player, dear friend, who's been with us for decades, likes to point out that actually Horse came out before Heart of Gold. And so he's saying that, you know, for people who thought, because it came out in 71 in England, and it was released until 72. But for Neil, who we did get to meet, and he's always been very nice to me, but there was a strange dynamic. Right after Horse, we got signed to his management company. And I think he was a little bit perturbed that Jeff and Elliot Roberts signed up these guys.
Right.
But what had happened was Neil had four solo albums. The first solo, Gold Rush.
Harvest.
Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. And then...
Harvest?
Then Harvest. So,
yeah.
And finally, with Harvest, he was number one. And he had a number one record for the... And so disturbing. Finally had built himself to this pinnacle position. And he was ousted after 1 week by this song that everybody thought was him. So he was only number one for a week before Horace took that position.
You know, I didn't know. That's a great story. I didn't know that. Do people still ask you about that? Do people still ask you? Yeah.
I tell you, the thing that you get more often than not, people will say, you know, something like, hey, have you ever named that horse? You know, there's like some kind of a reference. So,
did you?
And the truth is, yes, you know, Dewey and his wife, Penny, they've been animal rights activists, you know, seriously for decades. But one of the things they did a few years back is adopted a wild Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
And so they now, as a horse at their house, and they named that horse No Name, which is no name.
Sure.
So their horse is called No Name. So that horse now does have a name.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you for taking time out, calling us from Australia, filling us in, letting us know what's going on. And hopefully we're going to see you guys back in the States.
I hope so too, Denny. Nice to talk with you.
Okay, great. Thanks.
So that's Jerry Beckley, founding member of America. By the way, this interview was recorded from his home in Australia. Thanks for joining me on The Rock Podcast, the number one podcast for classic rock conversation. You can get in touch by writing to me at hello@therockpodcast.com. That's hello@therockpodcast.com. Watch this interview on YouTube, and while you're there, sign up to our channel. It's free, no charge. All you do is go to youtube.com/Denny Somack Productions. Just click on that subscribe button the red arrow is pointing to, and you'll never miss an episode. You can also find us on Facebook. Until the next episode of The Rock Podcast, this is Denny Somack saying thanks for being there, and goodbye till next time.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.